Welcome to another episode of Audio Dust Jacket. I'm your host, Kevin Finn, and in the studio today with me is my good buddy and co-host, Stone Payton. How you doing, Stone?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for inviting me to play on this one.
No problem. We're excited. We're kicking this off with a big start. First up on Audio Dust Jacket is the author of The Brandful Workforce, Julia Gometz. Welcome, Julia. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on the show, Kevin and Stone.
No problem. Tell us a little bit about The Brandful Workforce and why you decided to write it.
Yeah, well, The Brandful Workforce is all about a workforce that promotes the brand of an organization. And having worked at JetBlue for 8 years and started their employee engagement practice, I really had a lot of interest from colleagues from other organizations who were constantly asking me, how did JetBlue build this army of Brandful employees? And so I thought about it, and I really went on a quest to figure it out, and I really think I have some answers here in the book.
What was the hardest part about writing the book? Because I know sitting down and writing a book's not really easy.
You know, I think it was really getting all of the examples, because people really like to see practical applications. The model came pretty quickly and easily. And it's a really simple model on how a company would build a brandful workforce. But it was really digging in and taking the time to talk to folks all over the place, because I didn't want it to just be, you know, representative of one particular area or one region or one type of organization. So it was really bringing the model to life through the examples.
How did your past history really play into writing the book, and what do you want people to take away really from the book?
Yeah. Well, the past history is really, being at JetBlue and being among a brandful workforce. What I really want people to take away from the book is, that there's two audiences really here. One is organization, and it's a practical guide. And so for that audience, I really want them to see that their business model and their customer promise and employee promise are the three main ingredients that you have in an organization that's successful before you think about building a brandful workforce. I think the number one mistake a lot of organizations make is they want their employees to be out there promoting, but what are they promoting? They're promoting the actual products and services that have to be successful. They have to be exciting. So they have to work on that foundation before they move into the creating the brandful part. The book does talk about six key elements. Once you have those basics in place, how do you mobilize and provide vehicles for employees to express their excitement about the brand? So I talk about six areas, for example, citizenship, communication, celebrations, employee programs. And so that's pretty much the roadmap, and that's pretty much the takeaway. It's really a how-to, how do you create it in organizations. But the second audience, the employees, what their takeaway is really how do I live my career to the fullest? And I don't think people are doing that. I think people's attitudes these days, especially with unemployment so far up, is they just want to get a job. They don't care what it is. So the key takeaway is, hey, you're in charge of your career, and if you want to become brandful and work in a brandful workforce, you have to know what kind of products and services that you want to promote. And that typically hasn't been an angle in which employees go out and look for a job. So those, I think, would be the key takeaways.
Now, Julia, you have a consulting practice, a business. There's work behind this book. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, we do. We help organizations through this roadmap, build that brandful workforce. So we'll go into an organization. We'll do an assessment. We'll look at their business model. We'll look at their customer promise, their employee promise, and we'll see whether they have the foundation. Believe it or not, most of the time, a lot of the work is in this foundational end. But for those who really pass that, we'll work with these six vehicles that we call of being brandful. So do they really have fully in place these vehicles through which their employees can be brandful? So we'll go in and we'll help them with their communication strategies, particularly social media. Their employees are already on social media. So how do you really you know, provide the outlets, provide the information so that they can be brandful through that, through recruiting. There's a whole recruitment aspect. How do you bring in employees that are brandful? So there's so many aspects that we help organizations with through our consulting. We also, you know, I also do speaking and other, you know, engagements and executive advising.
What would you say be the hardest part to get the employees really to accept the brand, see it as their own, really live the brand of a company?
Yeah, and I think, so your question has to do with the existing employees, because as I mentioned before, you can bring in mm-hmm. folks who already are brandful, and the key to that is what I'm suggesting is organizations should be hiring from their customer base, and I think that's kind of a relatively new concept. But that your question was, how do you motivate the existing employees? And I agree with you, most folks really aren't that jazzed, they just want to come to work. But in terms of the existing folks, I think organizations really need to connect them to their mission. And I don't think companies and nonprofits, and this applies to all kinds of organizations, do themselves, you know, a favor. They're not looking at their mission as what really bonds and unites folks. So I've done a lot of research. I've looked at kind of some of the missions that organizations have, and are they really emotionally connecting? I'll give you an example. A company like FedEx, you know, hey, you know, some of these folks may just be, you know, going into their trucks, delivering their stuff. But when you look at it, and I really thought about it, I looked on their website, and they talk about providing access that has never before existed. And so if you look at it like that, Kevin and Stone, if you really look at it like that, it really gives much more meaning and purpose behind the organization. And so I think every organization exists for a reason. You're not going to be in business. You won't have customers unless you're providing something that's either needed or desired. Mm-hmm. So you have to get to that core. And that core is what really excites people.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you don't take anything else from this conversation, look to your customer base for potentially passionate, really invested people to put into your workforce and give the people, once they are on board, access and encourage and support their dreams and their objectives. I mean, that's strong mojo.
Definitely. I can definitely see where you're coming from about the foundation, though, because I know a lot of company owners don't want to think that their foundation's the problem, their employees are the problem, but I'm sure you find a lot of the time that convincing someone to change their foundation would be quite hard in changing the direction of their company.
Yeah, it really is, but I think, you know, that's the tough part. That's what leadership's all about is, hey, how is this company profitable? And in the competitive landscape and the global landscape, that has to be the core focus, because employees cannot get excited about a company or an organization that's going down the tubes. So they have to really keep focus on that and engage their folks in being a part of what makes their organization successful.
Have you seen any difference in the way you approach the brandful workforce with the new generation of millennials coming out?
When I think about millennials, I think that what they bring to the table is this: they really focus on meaning, and they are coming out of school, and they want to make a difference in the world. And one of the vehicles in this roadmap, where you can, you know, provide an outlet for your employees to express and promote the brand, is what I'm calling citizenship. And that is completely under-leveraged right now in organizations. Most organizations have a corporate social responsibility program, some kind of program to do good. Now, most of those programs are developed by marketing departments, which is fine. But most of these programs don't really involve the employees in meaningful ways. So if they could, and if when you go to an organization, they type out their corporate social responsibility program, if you were really dedicated to those programs, that would be an ideal outlet for you to be able to promote the brand by whatever it is they have, whether it's planting trees, Habitat for Humanity, curing cancer, whatever that organization is committed to. I know millennials are really interested in that, and that helps them connect the mission of the company with their work and be brandful.
Definitely. That makes employees actually probably go home, think about their company, want to better their company and everything. I completely agree. So if you had to pick one chapter from your book, just the best chapter, and you wanted to tell our listeners about it, what chapter would that be and why?
Wow, that is a really tough one. Oh, I don't know if I could pick one particular chapter. I guess it would have to be this whole foundational chapter, because I say there's kind of a couple of two sections, and you don't get to the second section of helping folks be brandful until you pass those foundational elements. And I have a big warning sign. It says, do not proceed unless you have this foundation right. And what I say is, hey, if I see this a lot, where companies want to just move straight and help and build this brandful workforce without considering their basics. And what they will do is they will create brand bashers. Because if you don't have an exciting product or service or mission, and you're not profitable or have a plan to be profitable, they will not be brandful. And that's just a key message. So I'd say that's probably the most critical, because I would just hate people to look at all of the six vehicles on how people can be brandful and skip over that part.
Yeah, if they had the other five and they didn't have that one, I don't think they'd be very successful.
Yeah.
So what's been the...
That being said, sorry, there are some really cool stories and anecdotes throughout.
Awesome.
So what's been the impact on the business? Has the book helped the business, help you command more speaking engagements, higher speaking fees, more work, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, the book is not actually for purchase yet. It's coming out in March, and I am amazed just how much traction it has, and it hasn't even come out yet. I'm absolutely amazed. So I'm really excited when this actually, you know, hits it out there for sale, because I've already started an executive roundtable with some Fortune 100 and 500 executives who are really excited about this, and particularly in the C-suite. Executives are already starting to use the term brandful, which I came up with as part of this whole model. They love it, and it's just – I've already got several speaking engagements, and the consulting has been great, and there's a lot of people who want to have partnerships. One particular area of folks that are really interested in this are advertising and marketing folks. Because with the loss of control that organizations have with their brand, they realize that their employees are just a key audience and outlet for them to promote their brand. And so it's really going to hit into that particular area as well.
Well, I'm a little bit bummed that it's not out yet, but I am so excited for you and for the good folks that are going to get a chance to read that. Before we let you go, let's make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you and learn about this book now and be prepared to purchase it when it's ready. What's the best way for folks to reach out and learn more?
Okay, they can visit my website at brandfulworkforce.com. There they can sign up for the advanced copy of the book. And I just want to also mention that when the book does come out, this book is going to be very engaging. There are links, and I hope that people get it purchased e-copies, because through that, there's going to be a lot of links. At the end of each section, there's a part where you can share your story, what you think, and contribute to the conversation. So this book is going to be really interactive. It's going to create a big community of folks interested in this topic, and I really hope everybody will join in. I'm on Twitter. My handle is BrandfulMe. Facebook, but the website has some also great examples of Brandful Workforces, some videos, and anything I see that's a great example, I post on there.
Well, Julia, it has been an absolute delight having you on Audio Dust Jacket today.
Definitely.
And maybe we'll have you back close to launch date as well and see how things are going.
Well, that would be great. I would love it.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks,
John. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
You too.
In just a few moments on Audio Dust Jacket, we're going to get a chance to hear from our second author. She has written the book, The Nanny Factor, A Parent's Guide to Finding the Right Nanny for Your Family. But before we go to her, I want to remind everyone for guest nominations and sponsor inquiries for Audio Dust Jacket, your email address is kevin@businessradiox.com. That's kevin@businessradiox.com. We're always looking for talented authors and people that have something worthwhile to say. So I think we're ready for our next guest.
Welcome, Candy. How are you doing, Candy?
I'm
I'm great. How are you today?
We are doing absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
I'm really excited to talk about your book because when I was growing up, my mom was a nanny, so I find all this stuff very, very interesting. Could you give us a little background of yourself and your company, Nannies for Hire, and why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, that would be great. You know, my name is Candy Wingate, and actually I started out as a nanny as well, just like your mom was, and I was a nanny for a family that actually had five children. And after working as a nanny, I also went ahead then after that and started working at a nanny agency. And nanny agency is actually an agency that actually helps families find nannies, vice versa, nannies find nanny jobs. And after working there, the owner actually wanted to sell it. So after purchasing the agency, I knew we had to find a more simpler, more cost-effective way for families to find nannies. And so then that's when we actually launched nanniesforhire.com.
Okay, well, let's talk about The Nanny Factor, A Parent's Guide to Finding the Right Nanny for Your Family. What inspired you to write that book, and what really, what's in the book?
Yeah, I mean, just through all my years of experience, I mean, I've had everything really that deals with a nanny. I've been a nanny, I've worked in a nanny agency, I owned a nanny agency, and then actually we started nanniesforhire.com. I just had a wealth of information that so many families and nannies actually would contact me saying, gosh, I know you've been through this. You know, what are your thoughts on this? How do I handle this? What would you do about this type of situation? And that's why I actually wrote The Nanny Factor book. And it's basically, it's a parent's guide to finding the right nanny for your family. And there's just a wealth of information in the book. Anything from, it talks about like nanny contracts. I mean, should I have a nanny contract or do we really need to have one?
Should you? Should we have a nanny contract?
Should you? Yeah. I mean, we're going to highly recommend that you actually have a nanny contract. And it's going to be a contract that's going to benefit the nanny and the family. And it's going to be a document that actually both the nanny and the family can refer back to during their time of employment that they can actually, that should answer all their questions. And, you know, things that should be in a nanny contract is, gosh, this is the days that I'm going to work. These are the hours. These are the benefits that I'm going to receive. This is the day I'm going to get paid. This is the amount, any holidays, paid vacation, exactly what my responsibilities and duties are. You know, so it's a document that anybody can refer back to if they have any questions about exactly what's expected of them.
Have you ever seen anything odd or crazy or weird in a nanny contract before?
You know, we don't actually see every contract. I mean, families actually will contact us and say to us, you know, can I put this in a contract? And my feedback to a family would be this. You need to discuss it with them. You know, when you are actually going to sit down and have the nanny sign this nanny contract, you need, it's going to be a contract that both parties are going to agree upon. You know, so make sure that whatever you're putting in there, you have actually already discussed with the nanny.
What do you think the biggest mistake that people make when they go to look for a nanny or the biggest misconception?
Probably the biggest nanny myth that I would say is that nannies are actually only for the wealthy. And the reason being that is, if really, if you have two or more children in daycare, a nanny can be very, very cost effective. And you can usually have a nanny for the same amount if you're actually paying for daycare for two or more kids. And on top of that, you can actually have all the benefits of having a nanny as well. You know, for example, so many parents and so many children are involved in so many activities that it's like, oh gosh, we need to get our child to this softball game or whatever it might be. And then on top of that, you're like, what are we going to do for supper? Okay, let's swing through the drive-thru. Well, a nanny can actually have that evening meal prepared. She can actually pick up those kids from school and help them do their homework, drive them to their activities, give them a healthy snack, plus make your evening meal. So when you come home, you can have that quality time with the children.
Wow. It sounds like nannies do everything from cleaning, cooking, everything.
So. Well, it sounds to me like that's part of the wisdom in having a contract, because you know what you want, don't want is a mismatch of expectations. If you're going to have those kinds of duties, you want that built in. Is that an accurate statement?
Exactly, yes. I mean, a contract should be all the information, exactly what's expected of your nanny. You know, a nanny's primary responsibilities are childcare, of course,
light housekeeping, grocery shopping, errands, carpool, laundry, meal preparation. So really, anything having to do with the children, a nanny would be responsible for as well.
And so how do you figure out how to compensate a nanny?
Yeah, how to compensate a nanny, it does vary. I mean, it varies on a nanny's past child care experience because, of course, the more experience you have, the more money that she would like to make. On top of that, it's going to depend on your location, the number of hours, the responsibilities as well. I mean, so some you don't have to hire a nanny full-time. You can hire a nanny part-time. Some families want a nanny before and after school care. Some families will actually just hire a nanny only for the summer. You know, they only need that summer nanny to come in so the kids can stay at home and have activities and be involved in things as well. So, you know, a nanny can be full-time, part-time, summer. And even some families will hire a nanny because both parents travel, and they need that short-term person to come in for 5 days, whatever it might be, while the parents travel for their job or whatever, or for personal reasons as well.
That's awesome. How has writing this book helped your business, have you found? Or how is it related to your business?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, all this information in the book is things that I actually have dealt with, or it's a lot of the questions that families come to us and say, gosh, what can we do? How can you help me so I can figure this out with my nanny? And there is a copy of the contract in here as well for families to use, and so they understand what's on that as well. It's a resource guide for families when it comes to hiring a nanny. Not every family knows what to look for in a nanny. I mean, some families are like, gosh, you know, I think I know what I need in a nanny. I think I understand what their responsibilities would be, but I have a unique situation. I have a child with special needs. Can they help and work with my child? And that question would be yes. I mean, you know, so many families are like, gosh, how do I go ahead and keep a nanny? I mean, how can I make sure that she's happy and make sure that I keep the lines of communication open? And because I work these hours, my husband comes home and relieves the nanny, and I'm going to come back and say, have a notebook. Have a notebook in the kitchen area where the nanny can write down what exactly happened throughout the day. If there's any questions that she has for you, if the one child coughed a lot, she might be coming down with a cold. So, you know, if you don't actually are going to be able to have that in-person communication, have a notebook, have a journal that you both can write notes back and forth to each other as well.
Do nannies have any kind of special certifications to give shots, insulin shots, like medication? Or is that something I could get in a nanny?
Every family looks for something different in a nanny, and every family has a different need. I mean, if you're going to need a nanny that, let's just say your child is a diabetic, maybe that's what you're referring to, and you're going to need a nanny who's going to do that, you're going to have to hire a nanny that has some background in that, a nanny that actually feels comfortable with doing that. You know, I know there are nannies that actually will go and do some special training so that they can actually administer that medication directly to the child and feel comfortable doing that as well. Nannies are willing to work with you as well as a family so that they can actually meet your needs as well. You know, majority of the nannies are, you know, CPR first aid trained, but maybe you need more than that, like you said, somebody who's a child has a special need or needs special medication. And, yes, there are nannies that will actually help you out with that as well.
In your opinion, what are the five most important things or things for a nanny to have, like characteristics?
Yeah, like we said, every family has a different need, but, you know, you have to make sure that your nanny fits your family. I think that's the biggest thing to look at is, you know, what are exactly your needs of a family? And that's going to go back and we're going to say is, gosh, you know what, I have a child that's special needs. I have a child that is involved in a lot of activities, so I need somebody who has a very clean driving record. I have a child that possibly does not do well in math, so I would love it if my nanny could go ahead and work with that child on math after school so we can help them bring their grade point average up. So I think, you know, one of the things is, hey, what are your needs? Sit down and decide, okay, what do we really need as a family? And then how can a nanny benefit our family? Is it going to be a benefit that she does the grocery shopping for us? Is it going to be a benefit that she goes ahead and, you know, prepares that evening meal and helps with the homework? you know, whatever it might be, or is it, do I want my nanny to sit down and read to the children every day for an hour? How can a nanny benefit our family and help simplify our life as well? You know, some families think that, gosh, if I have a nanny, my my kids are going to be excluded from other kids, and that's not true at all. I mean, nannies can go ahead and do play dates with other nannies and their children, and they can take them the children to classes and things like that. So your children actually feel that they're just involved with other children in activities as well.
So a nanny is basically like an extension of your family, you'd say. They become another family member.
Yeah, I mean, nannies can actually live in with the family, and if they live in with you, you provide them with a room in either a private bath or a shared bath. And nannies can actually live out, and what I mean by that is they just come and go during the hours that you need them. So a nanny can definitely become an extended part of your family. It depends on how well you want the family involved. I mean, I know there are some nannies who actually go on vacation with the families.
Really?
And they help with the children along the vacation as well. And there's some nannies that, you know what, they even show up at the kids' sporting events. But on the other hand, there's nannies that come in and they work their hours and then they go home to their family or they go home and have their social life as well.
Are there some go-to interview questions that you would advise that you always or almost always ask when you're interviewing a nanny?
Yeah, it's, you know, the interview process. And I'm going to highly recommend that when you're actually starting to interview a nanny, that you start out with them possibly with an email or talking to them over the phone. And this is what we definitely recommend at Nannies for Hire. So you're going to go ahead and contact that person, send them an email. Hey, I like your qualification. This is what I'm looking for. And then on top of that, you're going to want to go ahead and schedule a time after that to meet them. And I'm not going to recommend at this time bringing them over to your home. I'm going to recommend that you go ahead and meet them at a local coffee shop, a bakery, something like that. And your children at this time do not have to come along, because you as a parent are trying to weed out maybe your top three candidates that you think. And I'm going to highly recommend that you go with your gut of which nannies you actually want to introduce your children to. Once you've actually narrowed it down to, hey, I really like this nanny and I think she's going to be able to meet all of our needs that we have as a family, then go ahead and maybe bring her over to your home and go ahead and have her interact with the children and see how that goes. And there are, yes, some common questions that I'm going to ask when you're looking for a nanny, when you're interviewing them is, you know, what do you like about caring for children? Why did you leave your last job? How long have you been a nanny for? I mean, what kind of child care classes have you taken? You know, do you drive? What's your driving record like? Tell me about your family life. This is a normal day in our family. How would you handle these issues as well? But there's so many more list of questions, and you can find a detailed list of questions that you should ask a nanny in the book, The Nanny Factor, as well.
That seems like a really just tough process, and I bet it's really hard for most families just because they're putting someone else around their kids, who are probably the most precious thing in the world. How does Nannies for Hire really help me, someone that doesn't know, one of our listeners that doesn't know how to really do this process? How do you guys help guide them through the process and get the perfect match?
Yeah, and nannies4hire.com, it's a very simple process as well, though. How it works is you simply go online, you punch in your zip code, and then it's going to bring a list of the nannies within your area that are actually looking for employment. On that, it's a very detailed list. It's going to show you what the nanny's past child care experience is, why she wants to become a nanny, these are the hours that she's looking to work, this is what her past family life is like. So you as a family are going to know a lot of information about this nanny even before contacting her. And then once you become a registered member, you're going to get all the detailed contact information on her. You're also going to have access to sample interview forms, questions that you can actually ask the nanny. So we're going to guide you on giving you all the resources that you need to make the right decision. I'm going to highly recommend when you're checking the references on a nanny that you actually ask the nanny for landlines and not cell phones, because you can track that information and make sure, hey, that you are talking to the right person as well.
What a great tip.
That is a really good tip.
Check their references of their current and current employment as well. Hey, yeah, she is working at this place, and yes, she's worked there as well. You know, you need to make sure that you're hiring the right nanny. And then definitely run your background checks on your nanny. And I'm going to highly recommend that you definitely run a criminal record, a driving record as well on your nanny.
So what was the favorite part about writing this book, and what did you find a little bit challenging, if not downright frustrating, as you were putting this thing together?
Yeah, I mean, I have so much of wealth of information that we actually put in the book, but I had to make sure that it was as well that this was a book that gave the family all the key and all the resources that they need when it came to hiring a nanny. So much of this is just, oh, gosh, I know this, but then you always had to refer back and say, but not every family understands this, and not every family would know what I'm talking about as well. So sometimes when things are so easy for one person, you have to make sure when you're writing it out that is you're actually writing it so people can really understand it as well.
So let's turn the tables a little bit and help the nannies out. What are some pieces of advice, if any, that you might have for nannies that want to go to the marketplace, be prepared, find a good fit for them? What are some things that they can do to prepare or maybe some things that they should definitely not do in pursuing those kinds of positions conducting themselves in those interviews?
Yeah, especially in the job market right now. I mean, there's a lot of males and females both, because male nannies can also be nannies as well, you know, that are actually looking for employment. Maybe you're somebody that you have a teaching degree, but you can't find that teaching job, and, you know, they will become nannies as well. You need to decide, gosh, these are the hours that I can work. I'm looking for full-time employment. I'm looking for part-time. Or maybe I'm just looking for a summer job because I would love to do this in between, because I am a college student. And there's lots of college students, actually, that will become nannies for the summer as well. So you need to know, hey, these are the hours that I can work, and this is what I can give a family. I love sports. I'm very athletic. I'm a swimmer. I've been a lifeguard. I've worked in a daycare before. I've been a nanny before. I've worked in the church nursery before. I'm taking early childhood degree. I'm going to graduate, with my master's on such and such date. I mean, so any information that you can give the family about you so that when you're looking for a position, a family can get to know you is what you need to remember, because you need to tell the family, these are the qualifications that I have to care for your children.
Have you found it hard? Because you said you deal with male nannies, too. I would think that most families wouldn't want male nannies, and they would have a really hard time in the workforce.
Well, you know, not necessarily. I mean, because let's just say that you're a single mom and you're raising all boys. They actually want that male nanny in the household. Let's just say that, you know, you're not even a single parent. There's two parents raising children and you have all boys. They, you know, people love that male nanny in the household. So, yes, there are male nannies that are, we call them mammies.
I like that.
So, yes, they are. There are male nannies that will actually do that. And there's family. They just love them as well.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you visit with us today. This has been Candy Wingate with 100 Tips for Nannies and Families. It's actually the Nanny Factor, and it's let's make sure that we get the title right and that our listeners are able to contact you, Candy.
Yeah, the name of the book is called The Nanny Factor. It's the parent's guide to finding the right nanny for your family. And, I mean, it's going to give you a wealth of information on, you know, over, like, the health benefits for your child of having a nanny in your home, to the what are the nanny myths and the real truths of hiring a nanny, and how do you hire a right nanny that's right for your children's needs, and, you know, what do you pay a nanny? How do you stay in touch with a nanny while your children are at work? So it's a wealth of information that actually is going to help you and guide you through the hiring process of hiring a nanny. And my name is Candy Wingate. I'm the founder of nanniesforhire.com, which is nannies, N-A-N-N-I-E-S, the number 4hire.com. I'm also the owner of careforhire.com, babysittersforhire.com, and a nanny agency, Nannies of Nebraska.
That's a lot of .coms.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I mean, we've had some great success. Actually, we work with the Dr. Phil Show. We've helped Kate Gosland of TLC find nannies on John and Kate Plus 8. We've been with the Super Nanny Casting Services before. So, We have a wealth of information that we can actually help a family in locating the right nanny and vice versa, helping a nanny find the right job that's right for her as well.
Well, thank you again so much,
Candy.
Thanks
for coming on.
Look forward to visiting with you again sometime.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce an author from The Game of Golf and the Art of Business. And I'm going to booger his last name, but please welcome to the show, if you will, Scott Seiferlin. How'd we do, Scott?
Good morning. Very close. Hey, don't worry about it. I just figured it out last week. Tough one. It's Seiferlin.
Seiferlin, okay. Well, welcome to the show, Scott. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you. How about you?
Good, yeah. So so I see here you've written two books. You have Stop Slicing in Five Swings, The Seven Golf Myths and Destroying Your Game, and you also have The Game of Golf and The Art of Business. Why did you decide to write those books? I know you're very successful, very great golfer. You've trained some of the best. What led you to write these books?
I've been interested in writing books for several years, but didn't know exactly the process of how to go through it, get it published. And then just over a year ago, I was fortunate to be introduced to Greg Smith, who is now my publisher, and he's based out of Holland, Michigan. And he helped me through the process of getting it done.
Tell us a little bit about your books. Tell us what they're about, what they help people do.
Sure. The first book I published, The Game of Golf and the Art of Business, is an entertaining story about a character that I took through a round of golf at famous Bethpage Black Golf Course. It's famous for hosting two U.S. Opens, and it's also a course that I'm familiar with, having played in two New York State Opens. And we go out and play a round of golf out there, and he desires to be able to accomplish or conquer the golf course, I should say, and he hires me to coach him through this round of golf. And through that round, he discovers many different challenges, and we talk about how to overcome those challenges, how they relate to the golf course and beating each hole. But then we also discover that each one of those challenges is related to an area of his business in life and how we can overcome those. So we give, at the end of each chapter, we give tips on the business and life aspect of it as well.
That's awesome. Yeah. Why do you think golf is such a great business sport? Because I love playing golf. I'm horrible at it, by the way, just absolutely terrible. But I love playing it, and it's just such a great networking tool. You go out there, you play golf, trap someone on the golf course for hours at a time, and they have to sit there, drink beer, and listen to you the whole time. But why do you think it's such a great networking tool?
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic because you have a captive audience for a period of at least 2 hours if you're playing nine, or at least 4 hours if you're generally playing 18 holes. And it's also in an atmosphere where neither person has the upper hand. It's not in a office setting or boardroom setting. So it's an equal setting. And where else can you find yourself in a situation where no matter how good you are, you're going to have moments of failure. You're going to have a shot where it goes into the trees and everybody is, you know, it's like, oh, even the best players have things like that happen to them. So it's an excellent avenue to build relationships.
Definitely. What was the hardest part about, you said, writing this book? You said you didn't think you could write a book. You always wanted to. What was the hardest part out of all this to write these two books?
The hardest part is just getting started. You've got these ideas, but you're basically working off of a blank slate and you're thinking, okay, how do I actually put this together? And I have a busy career, working upwards of 14 hours each day, so when do you find the time to do it?
Definitely. Did you find the second book easier to write than the first?
Yes, the second book is actually a smaller version of, well, it's a larger version of a very small report that I had done. So I had already done some of the legwork for it, and it's an instruction book, so I've written many instruction articles. And that was much easier for me because I've already written so many of the articles, and I put them. And then the work part of that was putting it together and getting that published in a fun, entertaining format.
So tell us about the business side of writing a book. What's that been like? Has it been good for business?
It has. It's opened up opportunities that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I found that generally I wasn't hired as a speaker to talk about slicing or to talk about how to hit a chip shot, things like that, from a business aspect to corporations in the area. And now that I've published The Game of Golf and The Art of Business, I've had several companies that have already hired me to do keynote presentations at their company event. It's two large insurance companies and a financial advisor company that teamed up with a CPA company. So that it's opened up doors that I wouldn't have had otherwise, and then that trickles down into ultimately my core business of coaching.
So I have a question around that as well. How do you provide an engaging speech without stealing thunder from the book, or do you not worry about that and they just complement each other?
Well, my publisher did a great job of helping me build a keynote presentation that highlights topics of several of the chapters in the book, but we actually take different stories. We don't use the stories in the book. We take stories from my own experiences playing competitively, and also I take some stories of clients that I've worked with from both a standpoint of when they've struggled and from when they've had success.
Could we impose on you to share a brief story maybe that helps illustrate a key point from one of the books?
Sure. One of the topics in my book is a topic on grinding, and I'll tell you a short story about when I played in the 2005 New York State Open. I was at a qualifier for it. I wasn't exempt for it, but I was at a qualifier, and through 14 holes, I was 6 over par. So typically at a state open like that, 2, maybe 3 over par gets in. So here I am on the 15th tee, 4 holes to play, no chance of qualifying, right?
Right.
Not feeling very good. You just kind of want to bury your head in the sand at that point. And so I tee off on 15 and basically just shank it all over into the barranca, and I'm real frustrated, slash another ball out. Somehow I'm up by the green and on my third shot, and but I'm still grinding away at it. I'm still thinking, okay, I've just got to go through the process and hit a good shot here. I'm looking at it from every angle. I give it the old Arnold Palmer hitch, and then I hit the shot, and it takes the slope, and it's a double breaker, it's a chip shot, and it goes in. So that was surprising, but I'm still at 5 over at that point, so still not a lot of hope to qualify for this tournament. But the next hole, I get up there, hit one about 20 feet, and I'm looking at that putt from every angle, trying to make that one for the Gipper, and that one goes in. So then the 17th hole is a par 5, and not too difficult, but you still got to hit some good shots. So I hit a couple good shots up there, and I'm just offside of the green, hit a real nice chip shot, and up to 6 feet, and that one goes in. So now I'm on 3 birdies in a row after a real tough day, but I just kept grinding, and all of a sudden I started to feel some confidence at this point. You know, I wasn't exactly like Ian Poulter at the Ryder Cup, but I was starting to get the feeling that I was grooved in. And the last hole is a real tough par 4, long par 4, and I hit pretty solid drive and started to really feel like I was in the zone at that point, and just peered an iron shot in there to about 4 feet and rolled that in for my 4th birdie in a row, and that sealed my trip to the New York State Open. I was able to qualify and play in that tournament. So that was a cool example of, you know, when things aren't going well, you still stay focused on the process and grind through the process rather than focused on the result and getting frustrated, then you have at least a chance. It doesn't always happen perfectly like that, but you have at least a chance of falling back into that zone. So that's kind of a good example of a story that I share with people. When things aren't going well, they always ask me, well, how do you get into the zone? And it's not something you can just automatically turn on, but if you go through the steps of focusing on the process, it increases your odds of falling back into the zone and really performing at your best.
I love that story. That's great. I would love to talk about the game of golf and the art of business. What are the key points you want people to take away from that book?
Implementation, hopefully. I've set it up as an entertaining story, so that's the number one thing.
Yeah, I think that's really cool.
They're going to enjoy the book. And I've had a lot of people that say, you know, this was a great book because I was able to sit down and read it in one night. It's 160-some-odd pages, and I was able to read it in 3-4 hours. And I really enjoyed it, enjoyed the stories and the experiences that the client had with you. But at the end of each chapter, I have a takeaway that they could also apply to their business. So that's what my hope is that they'll take that away and apply it to their business and see success as a result of that.
Okay. Have you had anyone actually take them out on the golf course and sort of walk them through this experience, like a live interactive book where you do that? People hire you to actually take you through playing golf and also the business practices?
Well, we're still working on that exactly as you said it. I've had as my core business, I do many, many coaching sessions on the course where we take them through strategy on the course. And I've been applying a few of the chapters in the book. I have fun with some of my clients now because now that I have the book out, I give them examples and I say, "No, that was from chapter 7 of the book." So they get a kick out of that.
So the title that caught my eye was "Stop Slicing in 5 Swings: The 7 Golf Myths That Are Destroying Your Game." Can it really be done in 5 swings? Can you make meaningful progress? And what are one or two of these myths that we ought to know about?
Yes, to answer your first question on the stop slicing, there's 4 key areas that cause a slice. And through proper evaluation, you discover which one is the most predominant. And usually, if you handle that, you can usually get them to stop their slice. Sometimes it's more than one of those key 4 areas, but for most people, it's just one, sometimes 2 at the most. I've really rarely ever run into somebody that has 3 to 4 of the slice factors that are causing their slice. Usually it's just 1 or 2.
Huh.
So once I take them through the evaluation and get them to understand that that's what's causing their slice, then I take them through movement patterns without hitting a ball to change their body movement and motion patterns, and that gives them a different feeling, and then it produces a different result with the path and the angle of the club face as it strikes the ball. And within 5 swings of them hitting balls, then they're not slicing, usually less. So sometimes people on their first or second ball will hit a draw, and it just amazes them.
And some of these myths, what's one or two that you can share with us?
Sure, I will share with you. You know how every time you're with somebody out on the practice tee and you can overhear some of the other people, and you'll hear someone complain that they're not hitting that well, and their friend will go up to them and they'll say, "You know what you're really doing? You're just swinging too fast." You've heard that, right?
Yep. My dad tells me all the time.
That's actually a myth, because you can't swing the club too fast. The best players in the world are the fastest swingers of the golf club. It's really more in relation to tempo, where you're swinging too fast, where you're swinging too slow. But the problem is when most amateur golfers and average Joes hear that advice that they need to slow down, what they will slow down is they'll slow down their backswing, and then they'll still keep a real fast pace in the initial part of their transition, so it's out of sequence. And what they don't understand is the actual proper sequencing versus slowing down or speeding up. So the best players have actually a relatively fast backswing. Most of the players that you see on tour are completing their backswing in 7/10 to 8/10 of a second. And then their downswing is generally around 3/10 of a second. But it's the transition that's really important. And it's more about timing and tempo than it really is about just slowing down or speeding up. So for the most part, if you hear somebody say you need to slow down, it's just a myth in that you don't need to slow your club speed down. You need to learn proper tempo.
Kevin, this makes me want to have a golf show.
I'm down for a golf show.
I mean,
definitely.
What? We were talking 8 or 10 minutes. I've learned more about golf in the last 8 or 10 minutes than I've known my entire life. Do you get a chance to work with kids much? What's that like?
Yeah, kids are a lot of fun. I like to work with kids when they're inspired. And they make progress quickly. They're very good visual learners. They really get excited. So, for the most part, about 90% of my business is private coaching with adults. But we do work with the kids sometimes, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a very interesting conversation. I'm so delighted that we came across you and your work. I want to make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you. So give us some coordinates, website, email address, so that the good folks that are out there listening can get their hands on this work and improve their game and improve their business.
The very best place is Grand Rapids Golf Lesson.com. Lesson is singular. That's Grand Rapids Golf Lesson.com. and that has all the coaching info and the book info and media info, everything that they would ever need.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and we really enjoyed having you. This is
thank you. I appreciate it.
No problem, Scott. Well, this brings us to a close of another Audio Dust Jacket, and we'll see you next week, same time. Thank you.